I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Dr. Nazanin Galdadari, optometric physician and owner of IMAX Eye Care in Murray, Utah.
Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Iran, but I actually grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. We lived in England for 3 or 4 years, but then we migrated here to the United States after the revolution. And I've been here since, so over 40 years.
What did your parents do?
My father was a judge in Iran, and my mom was a nurse and a hospital administrator in Iran as well. They were both, you know, from a very educated family, and, you know, for them, education was very important. And so when I was younger, they decided that the best education was a boarding school in England. And that's how we went from Iran to England. They were going to put me in a boarding school, and I just had a hard time separating, being an only child, separating from my parents. So the drop-off at the boarding school ended up keeping us in England for 4 years.
Wow.
So that's how we went from Iran to England.
So how
while we were there, the revolution started, and we have family here in the United States, and decided to come visit the family. And that's when things escalated in Iran and decided it was better to stay here rather than go back.
So how old were you at the when you started boarding school?
I was the only child in boarding school that got to go home at night, which didn't sit well with the other kids, I might add. I was probably 4 years old. Yeah, 4 years old. And I'll tell you, the British educational system was a lot different than here. There they could hit you and yell at you and punish you, and I mean, it was very strict. I remember lunch hall, the first time I started school here, it was in third grade, and the idea that you could sit with whoever you wanted to sit at lunch and eat whatever you wanted to eat, and if you didn't want to eat your lunch, you could actually throw it away. That was kind of cool, coming from a school where, you know, we all had to eat lunch with the headmaster and at a big table, and you had to finish everything on your tray, and you couldn't start eating until the headmaster said you could eat, and when she said it was done, you were done. It was kind of fun coming here and going to school here.
I had no idea that that sort of regimentation persisted in the 1980s like that.
It's different now. I mean, I have a friend who's actually lives in England, and their child goes to the same boarding school that I went to, and it's a lot different. I mean, it's a lot different now than it used to be. But I'll tell you, that early regimented, structured kind of style of teaching and education, I think for me was important because it kind of set the foundation for me as to you know, what I had to do, and that you put one foot in front of the other and you do what you got to do. There is no whining. There is no, I don't want to do this. You do it, and you do it without complaining. So I'm happy. I mean, it was a good time. It was a good time. I just didn't want to sleep over there. I liked it. I mean, looking back now, my son goes to a private school. Mm-hmm. And is it the degree that boarding school was? Absolutely not. And I don't think that his spirit could take that. But you know, I'm glad. It instills in them that the work ethic that you kind of have to have for the rest of your life. You know, you quit your whining, get it done, and move on. So I liked it. Looking back, I liked it. At the time, it was kind of scary.
How did you get from biology and chemistry to ocular diseases?
Oh, my gosh. I was talking with my husband about this, and I said, do I tell him the real story, or do I tell him what everyone else says? And I finally decided if I tell you the real story, it would be more authentic and more genuine. The way I went from a degree, an undergraduate degree in biology and chemistry to optometry school was I knew at the end of my degree in biology that I did not want to pursue the degree any further. I was a social person. I didn't like animals. I didn't like, you know, rats and all these other animals you worked with in the biology labs. I didn't like test tubes. I didn't like the smell of the chemistry labs. And I really couldn't see myself spending rest of my life either teaching in academia for biology or working in a lab, in a research lab. I couldn't see myself doing that. And I knew that I wanted to be around people. I knew that I would do well in a situation where I could interact with other folks, where I could impact someone's life. But being impatient, I wanted to see the results of what I was doing immediately. And so I thought, okay, healthcare. I'll go into healthcare. So I applied to law school, applied to dental school, applied to medical school, and applied to optometry school. And I was always a good student. I graduated with high honors and Pi Beta Kappa, or Pi Kappa Beta, the honor society at college. I had good grades. I had the good test scores. And so I applied to all these different programs. And I was lucky that I got accepted to, you know, a law school in New York, and dental school in Boston, and optometry school across the country, because I wasn't sure where I wanted to go, so I applied to a whole bunch of optometry schools. And, of course, law school at the University of Utah. And my problem was that during the same time, my mom had a health issue come up. And I'm an only child, very close to my family, and I knew I wanted to be close to home. And the schools that I was accepted to were on the East Coast. And so I didn't want to be, you know, a 5-hour, 6-hour flight away from home. And so I chose optometry because it was closest school to Utah, but yet allowed me to spread my wings a little bit. So that's why I said no to law school. It was at the University of Utah. I'd already gone to school there for 4 years. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to get away from that school. And so optometry school seemed like the closest place geographically to my home. And that's how I fell into optometry.
Speaking of family, I think you worked for 11 years, do I have that right, with your spouse?
With my husband. He had multiple leases as a lens crafters. And straight from school, I was working as an optician while I was waiting for my license, for my Utah State license. And they had a doctor that was leaving and said, would you like to work for us? And I said, sure. So that's how it all started. You know, I was his employed, one of the employed doctors. They had multiple locations. I was one of the employed doctors. And I enjoyed it. It was, you know, the retail setting taught me a lot about speed and dealing with different types of people and different interactions, and it was a good opportunity for me to learn at someone else's expense, so to speak. And it was good for him because as our relationship developed and when we started dating, you know, several years later and when we got married, I was more invested in the business than just a regular doctor that he was employing, because you know, it was even though it was his business, I felt like it was my baby too. It was something that I was involved on, and I wanted to be successful, and I wanted him to be successful, and so I think we both benefited from that situation.
So, what was it like to work with your spouse?
We never really worked at the same time because there were four different locations, four different offices. I was basically managing one office. He was at another office, and he had employed doctors at the other two offices. So we never were in the same office simultaneously. And credit to him, he let me run that one office that I was in, which was the busiest one, pretty much however I wanted to. I would be lying if I said that I wasn't a control freak, because I am and I was. And I wanted it to be done a certain way. And under the umbrella of the corporate setting where you have rules you have to follow and things you have to say and do, I was still able to do pretty much what I wanted to do at that location. And so I had a sense of autonomy. You know, this was kind of like my mini practice. It was fine. It was good. I was, you know, he was fair. I was very well compensated. He always backed me up. It was a good situation. What ultimately happened, though, that I left the practice after 10 years, I think 10 or 11 years, was that it seemed like, you know, the practice had grown so much. There was a lot of patient loyalty, and I just felt like I didn't think it was a good fit for me anymore.
So when did you know I want to start my own practice separate from my spouse?
I had been, I think, the fact that I had been at the same office for 10 years and I had seen same patients. Of course, in a corporate setting, you have a lot of new patients that come in. But I was really fortunate in that I was able to also develop somewhat of a loyalty with some of the older patients. So I was seeing the same patients, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, you know, in the course of that 10 years. And I felt like as I was getting older, my patients were getting older, and their needs were expanding. It wasn't a quick, you know, exam on a young patient anymore. These people had other issues going on, other health concerns going on. And I felt like I just didn't have the time in that setting to really devote to those patients. And I wasn't willing to compromise on what I was doing in an exam room, but that also meant that the exams, you know, were more complicated. They took longer, and that just wasn't the setting for me anymore. I couldn't do what I wanted to do. Remember, we were in a retail setting. The store wanted us to push out a glasses exam.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I had patients with macular degeneration and cataracts and glaucoma. And you know, those patients may not necessarily be buying glasses that day, but they still needed that time and care. And I just didn't feel like I could continue doing that and providing that in that setting. And I had gotten so busy, you know, I had gotten so busy that I felt like I was just running so hard and I wasn't able to do everything that I wanted to do. And being in a retail setting, you know, you're obligated to be there 362 days out of the year. They don't care if you have a sick family member at home. They don't care if it's someone's birthday or anniversary. You need to be there. You need to have coverage there. And so I thought, okay, this the only way I can do that is if I work for myself and set my own time and my own rules and pursue it that way. And that's what happened.
How does having separate practices from your spouse affect your work-life balance?
Well, the funny thing is, after about being open for 2 years, my husband, who had always been happy with his setting where he was, I think he saw the difference between private practice and commercial practice. And the freedom that I had being in my own office, the autonomy that I had, I think once he saw what it was like on the other side, and I have to say he was very successful in commercial practice, extremely successful doing what he was doing. But there is some freedom that you give up when you work in a corporate setting. When he saw what the alternative was like, he decided he couldn't do that anymore. And so he left his leases, and he joined me in my private practice. So we've been together now for, I think, at my office now for, I would say, 4 years together. And it's again, we still don't work the same days, and we choose to do that, you know, consciously. He works 3 days. I work 3 days. I think it's hard because of our styles are different, our personalities are different. I think it's hard on the assistants when we're both in the office together. You know, it's one of us signs the paycheck and one of us figures out the paycheck. So who do you listen to? Who's the boss? I think it works out best that, you know, he's there 3 days out of the week and I'm there 3 days out of the week. And one of us is always home with my child and with our child and with my mom. And it seems to work out the best like that.
Now, a lot of private practice ODs talk about quality of service, but they don't go into much detail. Can you break down your practice focus on quality and overall patient experience?
Coming from a setting where we could only control the exam portion of the patient experience, I saw the problem with that. You know, we could have provided the best service to the patients. They could have been enthusiastically happy with the exam. But if they weren't happy with their glasses purchase or with how the services continued after the exam, you'd lose those people. And so having seen that happen at the corporate setting, I knew that it had to be different in the private practice. So when I opened, my focus was I had to set our office apart from any other experience in the healthcare field that these patients could have. It had to be more personal. It had to be more hands-on. And it had to be so uniquely different that they couldn't go someplace else and duplicate that experience. That's the basic tenet that the practice is built on. So if a patient calls in for a refill, you know, yes, we'll fax in the refill request to the pharmacy, but then we also go the extra step of calling the patient and letting them know that we faxed it in. The little things like that, where they know that what they asked us to do has been done, and we call them and confirm with them that it's been done. Or following through with the measurements for glasses. You know, yes, we have a highly trained optician that comes out and does that, but the final measurement is still done by the doctor. You know, little things like that where they know that not only is someone else, i.e. a technician or assistant, watching out for them, but I personally, or my husband personally, is involved in every aspect of their care, whether it's the exam process, the contact lens selection process, the glasses process, every aspect of their care, our hand is involved in it. And they know it, and I make sure that they know it, and that's what we base our practice on, personalized, individualized care. That's where we live and breathe.
Now, you networked and held open houses to reach out to physicians for patient referrals. Should more ODs evangelize optometry to physicians?
I think that we get lazy as doctors. I think that we, and I hate to say this, I think we open our doors and expect patients to flood in, and that's not how it goes. Yes, we have to market to the patients directly. Yes, we have to be on these insurance networks. But I think you have to reach out to the community around you. My office is in a professional plaza. You know, the person next to me is a dentist. The other person on the other side of me is a chiropractor. A door down from me is a dermatologist, a family practice doctor, psychologist. You know, when I opened my practice, before I actually opened to the public, I had an open house. And we invited these other professionals around us to come in. And I had also gone around and introduced myself to these other doctors with a little letter of introduction. I had taken some treats and a flower over for them just to introduce myself. And that helped. I mean, they had a face with the new person in the building with them. And I think it helped because it got us new patients. I mean, I opened up with a nice load of patients because a lot of my patients followed me from the corporate setting to the private practice. Mm-hmm. The private practice was only a half a mile away from the corporate setting, so it was, geologically, I was very close to the other practice, and so a lot of the folks came over. But I didn't want to just have my old patients. I wanted to have new patients as well, and so reaching out to these other doctors, I think, was beneficial. And I think a lot of doctors don't do that. You know, I don't know whether it's pride or whether it's the sense that, you know, if you build it, they will come. I don't know. But I think we live in a community, and we need to network with these people and be seen and see them. And, you know, I make referrals to the dermatology next door. I make referrals to the primary care doctor next door. And likewise, they make referrals to me. I think it's best for the patient, and it's best for our practice as well.
What would you advise a young OD who wants to follow your path?
Oh, that's a hard question. Again, do I give the right answer or do I give the true answer?
You know, well, we're after truth, not necessarily the right answer.
Right. I know. I have that. My son is 13, and and he sees the life that we have now. He doesn't remember when I was working 6 days a week because he was so young. He doesn't remember those things. He sees the big houses and the expensive cars and the vacations, and he thinks this is what optometry is. This is the kind of path that if I pursue optometry, I could have this kind of a life. And I think it's a different time now for optometry. I think that I've had patients come in and they've asked, you know, do you think we should pursue a career in optometry? And I tell them, you need to be very realistic. You know, healthcare is changing, and it will continue to change. And I don't think that optometry is on the demise. I don't think that this profession will not continue to grow. But you're going to have to change how you're doing things. And it takes a right kind of person with the right mindset to be able to be successful in this field. And I think those days of you open shop and you do well are gone. I think that you need to be innovative and you need to be creative and you need to be unique, and those things will set you apart and allow you to be successful. And I'm honest enough to say that not every person is going to have that kind of personality, that kind of drive to do what needs to be done to be successful in optometry. There are other healthcare fields that are probably easier to be successful in than optometry.
Do you have any regrets?
The only regret I have is missing so much of my son's early childhood. I regret that because I chose to go into an environment where I didn't have as much flexibility in my time. And I think maybe that's why the pendulum has swung so far to the other direction, where now I only work 3 days a week versus 6 days a week, where I used to work, you know, early on in my career. So that's my regret. I mean, if I could go back, I would probably not work as much as I did. I certainly didn't need to work as much as I did. I am competitive by nature. You know, I wanted to be the best and do the best and succeed. And so, you know, going back to the boarding school education, you put one foot in front of the other and you move on. But if I could go back, I probably would spend more time at home and less time at the office.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, you know, having a teenage son and your mother who's older, who's living with you, if your schedules, I mean, if you were working 6 days a week now, as opposed to not so much when you're younger, I mean, you'd be missing a whole different set of challenges.
True. No, you know, this summer my son said, he's just 13. He says, Mom, I really want to work in the office. And I said, Billy, he's 13 and 5'10". So he's still a child, but he's taller than me. I said, Billy, you know, I can't really have you interacting with the patients. And he begged and he pleaded. And I said, fine, you can come to the office. And I had him filing files, and I had him answering the phone. And, you know, there was such a sense of pride for him and such a sense of pride for myself. And the patients, it was kind of weird for him because patients knew him, but he didn't know the patients. And the way that the patients knew him is because they saw him grow up through the pictures that I had on my exam table, that they'd see year after year after year, and the stories that I, you know, recounted to them. And so they felt like they knew him. And it was kind of weird for him where, you know, he'd be putting a file away and a patient would say, oh, my gosh, Billy, you've gotten so big. Look how tall you are. And it would kind of catch him off guard. Mom, do these people know me? Well, they know you because of all your stories and your pictures and all the stuff that we've shared with the patients. You know, he wants to do what we're doing, and it scares me. You know, I got to be honest, it scares me because I think that it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a lot more difficult for him than it was for me. And like every parent, we want it easy for our kids, right? Yeah, you want to wrap them up in bubble wrap and wave your magic, you know, fairy dust and make everything perfect for them. And I don't know. I mean, that's the thing that I grapple with is, you know, it would be awesome for him to take over when we retire. And I think he, you know, he's a smart, bright child. I think he can go into anything he wants to go into, and I certainly think he can go into optometry if he chooses to do that. But I just worry that it's going to be different for him than it has been for us. Maybe his different will be even better than what ours is. I don't know.
Well, that leads me to my next question. What's something you would change about optometry the way it stands now?
What would I change? I think the public perception of what an optometrist is and what an optometrist does needs to be more developed, more, it needs, we need to educate the public better about what we are, what we do, who we are. I think that patients perceive optometrists basically as someone who fits glasses and contacts. I don't, you know, I think that, that we need to work more on educating the public as to what we are. For myself, I don't identify myself as someone who just does glasses and contacts. You know, I'm treating eye diseases. I'm treating patients' hypertension, diabetes. Usually, you know, because some of these people, I'm the first doctor that they see, maybe the only doctor they see the whole year. I don't just manage their eye care. I have to manage their health care. You know, uncontrolled hypertension, you know, I may not be able to prescribe the hypertension medication, but I'm the one that facilitates them getting in and seeing a primary care doctor and, mm-hmm. and coordinating mm-hmm. that care. And I think that while my patients know what I do, I don't think the general public knows what we can do. And that's where I would like to see improvement.
Okay, now we're going to get silly. Why a Lamborghini?
Oh, God. Why a Lamborghini? Okay. Why a Lamborghini? You know, a couple of reasons. Number one, I wanted something that I could share with my son. Why not fast cars, right? He's a boy. I don't play sports. I'm not into basketball or football or these other sports. So that was out of it. You know, cars, all boys like cars. He has every Hot Wheels car you can imagine when he was growing up. So I thought, okay, this is something that it could be a mother-son thing. Why Lamborghini and not a different brand? Well, you know, the Lamborghini community are an interesting bunch of people. It's a small community. Everyone mm-hmm. knows everyone. There's maybe 4,000 cars made in a year. So again, everyone knows everyone around the country who has these cars. And it's an interesting group of people. They're kind of kooky, kind of crazy, kind of different. They have a I don't care about what people think about me attitude, and I kind of it kind of resonated with me. The Ferrari dealership was kind of stuck up. And I gotta be honest, if you had turned me off, it really turned me off. So when I went to the Lamborghini dealership in Florida, they were a lot more relaxed. You know, the salesman had on shorts. Mm-hmm. You know, he threw me the keys and said, go drive it, see if you like it, versus the Ferrari dealership where they wouldn't even open the door. The car is on the showroom and it's locked. That's why Lamborghini.
Well, what? Tell me exactly, what model and year is it?
So mine is a 2000... This is the second one I've had. This is the 2015 Lamborghini Aventador Roadster. It's different from my other one. My other one was a Lamborghini Murcielago. They're both V12 exotics. And it's fun. You know, am I a speed queen? Absolutely not. It's just fun to do this with my son. We go on group drives. We go on car meets, car shows. It's something he enjoys, and it's something we can do together.
Where do you drive it?
Basically, you hit the speed limit in first gear, so you can't very much go very fast, very, very far. Mm-hmm. We typically stay with local shows. Mm-hmm. We've gone to a couple of national shows. You know, now that my son is getting older and we can do some of these shows where they you have to be an adult, the problem is I can't pull him out of school. So, you know, it's hard to hit some of the national shows, which are during the school year. We can hit some of the summer shows, but not the national shows that are mostly during the school year. But, you know, where do you park it? Where do you drive it? You park it in the garage. The term garage furniture really resonates with me now. And we're lucky because we do have, you know, a racetrack here in Utah. There's a racetrack in Vegas as well. Potentially, you know, there are tracks where you can take the car and let it out and have fun. But I'll be honest with you, Vernon, you know, as I'm getting older, I'm 45 now, as I'm getting older, you know, there's a little bit of fear that's crept in. You know, I don't want to be the person that you see in these chat rooms that that's featured in a crash video. I don't want to have my child be in an orphan because of some stupid decision of going reckless fast. And I also have to keep in mind that, you know, this is a time when he's looking at me.
Right.
I don't want to tell him it's okay to be, you know, driving 150 miles per hour, you know, on a freeway somewhere. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the dualities of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a super fast car, but I'm afraid to go super fast because I don't want to set a bad example for my child, and also I don't want to die.
Well, okay, now we get to the last question, and this one that we inflict on everybody.
Okay,
And it may or may not have something to do with a fast car. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
What is the craziest thing I've ever done? I've done a bunch of them. Okay, what's the craziest thing I've ever done? On a big scale, I bought a house without telling my husband.
Really?
Yes, that was the craziest thing. On a smaller scale, I bought the Lamborghini out of the blue one day. I tend to be pretty conservative in all other regards, believe it or not.
Well, a car is one thing, a house is another. How did that happen?
Yeah. How did that happen? Oh, my gosh. Okay, well.
And how did it go over?
Yeah,
it followed me home.
he's used to dealing with me, so I don't think he was too surprised. We had gone, my mom and I had, and my son, my mom and my son and I had gone to Vision Expo in Vegas. And prior to leaving, there was a Travel Channel kind of a show on Lake Las Vegas. And this was in the height of when Lake Las Vegas was thriving and doing great. My husband and I had just watched this Travel Channel show about this community that was being built out in the desert. So my mom and my son and I went to Vision Expo, and the show got done, and I thought, let's just drive out and see what this Lake Las Vegas place looks like. So we drove from the Strip down to Henderson and checked out the place, and it was beautiful. But, again, it was at the height of the real estate market, and places were really expensive. So I came back, and I told my husband about how great it was and said, I would really like to have a home there. And you have to realize my husband also has an MBA, so he's a bean counter.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the market's too hot there. It's crazy. You can't do that. I said, okay, fine. Well, fast forward a few years, the market crashed all over the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Vegas took a big, big hit. And since I knew how he felt about it the first time I brought it up with him, I decided that I wasn't going to mention anything. I had seen a house that on Zillow of all places that was for sale, and I put an offer on it without going out and seeing it in person.
Huh.
Which, for me, being as conservative and as careful as I am, that was kind of a risky proposition. But nonetheless, I did it, and next thing I know, they accepted the offer, and now I have to fly down there, you know, for the paperwork, and now I got to tell them, right? So I surprised them with a trip to Vegas and showed them the house that we now own.
Just pulled up in front of the house and said, here's the keys, it's ours.
This is ours now, what do you think?
Wow. Okay, that's
cool. It
turned
out okay, though. He enjoyed it. It turned out okay.
Well, Naz, it's just great talking with you today. That's all the questions I have for you.
It's very fun talking with you, too. It's very, very fun. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you.